Looking ahead to the weekend, firefighters hope to have the major wildfires in California at or above 50% containment, but they aren't all there yet. On Insight, CAL FIRE's director, Chief Ken Pimlott, will be here with Deputy Director of Communications Mike Moeller. Mike has joined us for almost daily updates. We'll talk about wildfire in the details and in the bigger picture as well. Then, the founder of the Sacramento Black Book Fair, Sac State Professor Emeritus Dr. David Coven, talks with me about his new novel, Raisins in Milk. He started the book in the 1970s and had encouragement from Toni Morrison. Now, finally, it's finished. In our second half hour, music from the new EP by the Sacramento band Fashionista Boyfriend. And this week's sound advice is a preview of Daydream Fest, a big music event this weekend. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Of the 27,000 firefighters on the wildfire lines in the western United States, about half are fighting fires in California. And the biggest fires in this state aren't yet at 50% containment, but they're getting closer. And usually at this time, we're connecting by phone to CAL FIRE's Deputy Director of Communications, Chief Mike Moeller. I'm happy to say he's actually in the studio with us today, Chief. Thanks again for your ongoing work and glad to have you with us.
No, Beth, thank you for having us.
We are also fortunate to have the director of CAL FIRE, Chief Ken Pimlott, in the studio as well. And Chief, I don't know how you made the time, but I'm really grateful you did. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I start with that idea of 50% containment? Containment's been increasing. We're not there at 50%, but is it appropriate for us at this point to have some sense of security or confidence about where the fires are going?
I think we can start to feel better about where these fires are going as these containment numbers come up. But for example, the Carr Fire and certainly the Mendocino Complex, these are very large fires, and the amount of perimeter is miles and miles. And so it will take some time to get control lines, either bulldozer, hand crew lines around all of that. But particularly on the Carr Fire, the spread has been slowed, and we've been able to repopulate communities. The threat to Redding and some of those areas there on the west or east side of the fire are certainly lowered. But, we're certainly not out of the woods yet. We want to see 100% containment on all these fires.
Chief Moeller, let's do some of the daily update that we've been doing each day. And the director just mentioned the Carr Fire, so let's begin there.
So on the Carr Fire right now, like the chief was saying, we're about 35% containment. Over 125,000 acres. The only thing that we see on that, like the chief said, we're cautiously optimistic. We still have a lot of open fire line, but we're expecting a red flag warning in that area this weekend. So again, cautiously optimistic, but firefighters are making good progress.
The Ferguson Fire to the south, and that one I understand is now pushing closer to the perimeter, and Wawona is being fully evacuated.
It is. And again, when we look at evacuation warnings, your listeners have to remember it's, there's a reason it's not right on top of the community. But it's always when we have open fire line in those areas, it's a threat. So if you're in that area asked to evacuate, please do so. But again, a lot of resources on that fire and crews continue to make progress. But again, Mother Nature plays a big part in that.
And we already had the announcement that Yosemite Valley will stay closed at least through Sunday. That's air quality, smoky quality. That's just intense and bad for everybody in the area.
It really is. And we work with our partners at the National Park Service. I mean, our goal is to get the park open, get visitors in there. But right now, being in the park, it really is. It's socked in smoke and the air quality and really just the safety of the public is still a concern for us.
The Mendocino Complex, and I think one of the fires in the Mendocino Complex is at 50% containment, but that's been massive. And as we talked about yesterday, could end up overtaking the Carr Fire in acreage before it's fully out.
It really is. And in fact, the chief and I were just talking about this. You know, we're seeing these larger fires are common now, over 100,000 acres. That wasn't normal. We're seeing that. But if these fires continue to grow, we could see these past the Carr Fire well over 100,000 acres. Yes, we have 50% containment. But again, that's a lot of open fire line, like the chief alluded to. That's miles of line that crews have to get to and contain that fire.
I'll emphasize that with the weather this weekend, there is a forecast for, again, temperatures 90 to 100 degrees in the valley. Red flag warnings will be across western Nevada, and we have both the air quality and the fire danger alerts. that new normal that we're being asked to take the word new out of. So the phrase being normal. Normal then, Director Pimlott, is quite shocking.
Normal is shocking. And almost every year we move into a different pace. This year is really outpacing last year, and we've seen some very extreme fire behavior. The Carr Fire had what can only be described as a tornado.
It probably felt like a volcano.
It certainly did for the people there on
the
fire.
People living there. Yeah.
It did. But this is extreme weather, and it's influencing the fire. It's influencing how we have to evacuate and how we have to very quickly provide advance notice. And all of these are very challenging conditions that firefighters are facing.
Let's listen to a few of the words that Governor Brown spoke yesterday at the Emergency Operations Center, because climate change, of course, is his platform. But to put that in the context of fires, he had some very personal words to say.
We're in uncharted territory. Since civilization emerged 10,000 years ago, we haven't had this kind of heat condition, and it's going to continue getting worse. I mean, that's the way it is.
So if that's the way it is, as the governor just said, how do you sufficiently expand and prepare your agencies in advance for a disaster season that is hard to predict?
So obviously, we have to be prepared for the long haul. And so as we're always planning ahead of the next fire, we're planning days and weeks out right now. How are we going to get firefighters rested? How are we bringing additional resources into the state for in preparation for the next large fire? As the governor said yesterday, we will have more fires this year. Peak fires are early for this time of year. So we have a long road. The kinds of things we're doing is bringing on additional aircraft. This governor and this legislature have been very forward-thinking in terms of providing the resources necessary. Cal Fire now has the ability to staff fire engines year-round in strategic areas around the state. We have been bringing on additional aircraft. We've actually got agreements now with a number of additional aircraft through the rest of the year. Including
Coast Guard aircraft, too.
Yes, we're currently, and again, it depends. We're waiting for Congress for a final approval, but we're working through a process to have some additional aircraft appropriated to Cal Fire from the federal government. And those are some mid and longer term processes that will help us build capacity. We're also looking at, just this year, hiring additional firefighters to help provide some more capacity and relief. So all of these are things we're thinking forward. But as we talked about yesterday with the governor, we continue to look forward to determine how we're going to continue to address this increasing challenge.
Knowing you were coming in today, I was thinking about the conversation we had toward the end of last year's fire season. So this is December, and I went back and listened to it. I'm pulling out a clip that we can all hear, because we were again referencing that phrase, new normal. And so let's just listen.
And so it's, how do we sustain this level year round? And that's what we all are having to look at. And it's taxing, and it's involving everyone. It's not just Cal Fire. It's our almost 1,000 local government fire departments across the state. It's our federal partners. It's law enforcement. It's local counties and communities who are having to work through this.
Was there ever such a network of cooperation and communication between agencies before in wildfire fighting?
I think California has always led the way, because we've always been challenged, but we have taken it to an absolute new level. The cooperation, the integration between all agencies, between non-governmental organizations, it's seamless. And we spent the day with the Red Cross and others in Shasta County yesterday. And it's just amazing to see how this entire network and system comes together.
So if that was December, you were preparing the budget that just kicked into place for our new fiscal year in July. What did you already know that you were going to need to do differently for this year? And we've had three big fires already. And I know that your vision is out ahead for next year. And what do you already know that still needs to change for next year?
So several things. Some key things is our helicopter replacement program. The governor and the legislature have approved replacing all 12 of our UH-1 Huey helicopters with S-70i Blackhawks. And so we're in the process of purchasing the first ones as we speak. So again, these are new platforms. They will be better situated to address the kinds of challenges we're facing. So that very key investment that the state's making.
I'd like to hear from both of you in terms of alerting the public, because you can have all the best equipment in the world, but if people aren't out of their homes in time, we're still left with the same loss of life and destruction. And I know there are different pieces of the alert system. There's satellite sensing of smoke. There are texting phone systems that are set up and have been affected. But talk to me about the car fire in particular, and what did or didn't work with alerting the public. Director Pimlott?
So obviously, evacuations were in progress. There was an evacuation. There were trigger points established, just like any fire, trying to determine, you know, how far out you go with evacuations. We'll be evaluating once this fire is done and things are controlled and we start getting the community repopulated as to what were those time frames. This tornado that literally ripped through the west portion of Reading, there was no way to predict that. There was no warning. And so to provide advance notice to the community was challenging. But these are lessons learned. We have experts from as far away as Kansas that are tornado experts. They're literally looking at it right now with many others, because we want to be able to better predict and determine these unusual events that are now occurring.
And Chief Mueller, you must be hearing this on the ground from reporters and from citizens in these communities that there were in some cases no alerts, or there were drive to the door warnings but no time to get out.
No, absolutely. And unfortunately, if we look back at the Santa Rosa and North Bay fires, that really put notification on the map. But what we have to look at is when the chief and we talk about it is not new normal, it's the normal. We have to lean forward with the public and educate them that, you know, infrastructure failed in those areas within the first hour of the fire. When we issue a fire weather watch or a red flag warning here in anywhere in the state of California, people have to realize that they should treat that like it was a tornado warning or a hurricane warning on the East Coast.
Meaning that should be the first step in thinking about evacuation.
Absolutely. And can't rely on infrastructure, because when we have these mega fires or devastating wildfires where we're seeing these weather phenomenons, infrastructure fails. We say it all the time in the fire service is situational awareness and have your head on a swivel. And we need the public to do that, because this is not going to change. It's not going to go away. And unfortunately, Santa Rosa, you think about it, that jumped a 6-lane freeway. It burnt down really an urban community. It's not if you're going to be affected, it's when. So, yes, the alerting systems, sign up for everyone you can. But again, you have to remember that when we issue those warnings or the weather service, it's going to happen, and we need the public to be ahead of that.
Was the warning to the public in the Reading area for the car fire effective?
I certainly think many, many people were evacuated. We were on the phone as this was evolving with all of our on-scene command staff who were all out actively engaged in assisting in the evacuations. And the highway patrol, local law enforcement, all quickly engaged to reverse direction on the highways and the roads. And yes, there was certainly congestion, but quickly they organized that evacuation effort and safely evacuated everyone. There were no fatalities involved in the evacuation. They were very, quickly moved out. And again, of a fire that moved this quickly, it was an amazing job getting all of those people out without more people being injured or killed.
And yet there are 6 fatalities on that fire. There are 2 fatalities on the Ferguson. I don't think there have been any fatalities in the Mendocino Complex fire.
There have not, no.
So lessons learned about that. What can be better or different next time?
So 2 of the fatalities on the Ferguson fire are firefighters. The others are civilians. 2 of the fatalities on the car fire were individuals who were firefighters fighting the fire. And then the tragedy of the individuals that lost their civilians who lost their lives there in Reading when the fire just burned through that neighborhood so quickly. Lessons learned, this is a dangerous job for firefighters, and we will risk lives to save lives. And we're very concerned about all of our people out there. We're at the beginning of August. This is a long road to hoe to get through the rest of the summer, and our people are going to get tired. And so it's our responsibility to make sure we're taking care of them. But we can't stop our commitment to protecting the public and the resources of the state. And it's a difficult, dangerous job. We need the public to engage and help us do their part. We want to put fewer firefighters in harm's way and law enforcement officers having to stop firefighting and evacuate people from their homes. We want them to find the right places to stop these fires and do that.
Chief Mueller, just a point of context for information. Sometimes the acreage we list in acreage burned includes acreage that was burned in a preventative sort of way, in setting an advance fire as a containment line. So how should we interpret, if we're going to get wiser about reporting and conveying information about fires, how do we interpret that phrase, acres burned?
Well, when we say acres burned, especially on an actually active incident, acreage burned may be, depending on what the operations section chief on the ground determines is the best case for fighting the fire. A lot of times we put fire on the ground to fight fire. It's very effective. There's what we call a go, no-go checklist that we go through. It's a very planned out operation. But when we say acres burn, that includes what we put on the ground to fight the fire, where we actually run the fire into itself. So when we show that to the public, when we show acres burn, that increase can also be part of the operation that we actually put on the ground.
That's very different than a prescribed fire that's done in a different time of year under a prescription, not under a wildland fire environment. We do keep track of, you know, we want to do much more of prescribed fire, but that's burning under a prescription that's in a weather window that we can control, that's lower intensity and actually has significant resource benefit and fuels reduction benefit.
Is it advancing our reporting again to, for example, say overnight the Mendocino complex had a flare up and it burned X amount of acres, but we as CAL FIRE burned X amount of acres in containment? Does it help the public to know that information?
It can, but again, when we have an active moving incident, you know, we report acreage. So what they do is really fly the fire line and map it out. So we're going off of the actual line. When we say acres increase, that could be an interior island that burned off that same night and burned interior acres. I mean, it's something that the public can know, but when we're doing it as an operational in an incident, for us to separate that, it's just it would be more difficult to explain to the public where it was on the fire, why we did it. And sometimes when it's operating or in the operation, it's needed immediately where we put fire on the ground. They're just going to map the perimeter. So when we say acres burn, that's including everything that we do on that incident.
That is CAL FIRE's Deputy Director of Communications, Mike Mueller. Also in the studio with me is CAL FIRE's Director, Ken Pimlott. Let's talk about forest management a little bit. And we hear the unbelievable number of standing dead trees due to the bark beetle infestation and the impact of the drought. So what about forest management? How can that be a more effective tool in dealing with the mega fires?
So Governor Brown's been talking about the impacts of climate on all sectors in the state, but certainly forest management and our forests being a significant one. And as a result, the 129 million trees succumbing to this epidemic level of insect outbreak, and certainly these fires that are occurring. We had a tree mortality task force that started several years ago to look at just the bark beetle challenge. And now we've expanded that role to have a task force that's addressing all of the issues surrounding the health of our forest. Idea being to bring all stakeholders together at all levels of government and non-government organizations and significantly increase the pace and scale of work we're getting done on the ground. We're currently treating over 250,000 acres through all kinds of fuels treatments and removing and thinning trees and prescribed fire. We want to increase the pace and scale of that significantly, and the governor has significantly supported through cap and trade funds. In the last several years, we've gone from $160 million 2 years ago to over $200 million this year. And now in the current budget going forward, we have another $160 million in cap and trade funding, all earmarked towards engaging in landscape level forest health projects, as well as fire prevention and fuels treatment projects on the ground.
Will you forgive me for this, but I want to understand why the fact that you're treating approximately 250,000 acres is a big number when we have two fires that in the last week have consumed 250,000 acres, and we know how much more of the state there is.
Yes, there's literally 31 million acres of wildland watershed lands that just CAL FIRE protects. On top of that are, of course, all of the federal lands in the state. We have to be strategic. It's not physically possible to treat all of that acreage. It's just not possible. So we're certainly increasing the pace and scale across the state, but we're doing it in strategic places, in landscapes where we can make the most difference, where there's strategic locations where we can reduce the intensity of these fires, where we can provide opportunities for firefighters to have a fighting chance, where the intensity is lower and they can actually do fire suppression operations.
Okay. Finally, I do want to address the budget numbers. And the growth of the budget in just the last 3-4 years has been phenomenal. When you compare what the budget is for firefighting in hundreds of millions versus the billions of dollars in damage that are happening, are we still vastly underfunded by your estimation, Director Pimlott?
This whole effort, and it's not just the response, it's all of the efforts around the impacts of climate change in the state are all things that we have to continue to invest in. To think that just a few years ago, we would invest $220 million from cap and trade funds just in forest health and fire prevention was unheard of. We continue to see significant support in getting this done. But yes, we're going to have a strong commitment, not just by government, by private sector folks, by partnerships, federal government, all of us together working to solve this challenge. And again, it's not just a government solution. It's the community solutions. It's really looking at all the aspects, land use planning, and it's ensuring that hazard mitigation plans are where they need to be. And funding, federal funding, often requires the necessity of having a hazard mitigation plan on file. And so we need to look at our development patterns and work with our local communities. It's all of this together.
Let's hear one more comment from the governor, and this is regarding his asking the legislature to get involved in assessing the responsibility of damages when there are costs from firefighting. And I think everybody knows that this is being confronted at the Capitol, but here was the governor yesterday.
My goal was to try to find a reasonable balance that would reward players, including utilities, for doing the right thing, but make them liable when they didn't take the steps that common sense and prudence would warrant.
And we're in a political transition time when Governor Brown, after so much experience in the state, will no longer be the governor. So is that a sense of concern, too, that politics could dramatically change the direction the state goes in policy?
Well, bottom line is insect mortality, fires, disasters know no political boundaries. And so we have to continue to push forward. There's really a bipartisan effort on forest management, unlike I have ever seen in my career, moving this initiative forward. We have both sides of the aisle realizing that more investment in forest health and forest management, more resources to support the efforts that we're doing, more engagement by local communities in both land use planning and hazard mitigation plans, all of that together. Everyone's in agreement that those are all the areas we need to keep working on. And I'm confident that this will continue to move this across. The stakeholders are so together and motivated to get work done by what we're seeing every day now that's going to transcend any political boundaries.
And just finally, again, because we're coming into a weekend, Chief Moeller, there could be more evacuations. Those fire lines are really volatile at this point. So what's the wisdom to give every listener, to give all of us right now?
Well, we always refer to it. Our website, readyforwildfire.org, and we preach it, and it shouldn't be white noise, that your listeners need to visit that website. Not only does it prepare your home, but it prepares your family for an evacuation, not just for a wildland emergency, for any type of emergency, but we're already off to the races in 2018. This is not going to stop. And as we go into these weather patterns, like I said earlier, the public needs to know that the reason we issue these is because high temperatures, low humidities, possibility of wind, that the public needs to have their situational awareness, head on a swivel, and prepare your family, exercise it. And if you're asked to evacuate, please do so early, safely. That way first responders can get in there and protect your property.
Well, I think we have to have conversations like this because we're all trying to figure out how to respond to what is going to be normal. I appreciate that you've been so attentive and available through all of this. And we're on August 2nd right now. We have August, September, October. Who knows how long this will go? So thank you again very much for your partnership in the communication about what's happening out there. And good luck. Safety to everybody.
Thank you,
Beth.
Thank you.
That is CAL FIRE Director Ken Pimlott and CAL FIRE's Deputy Director of Communications, Mike Moeller. Continuing coverage and links to the CAL FIRE incident page are at capradio.org. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Now we are going to take a step back in time to the Jim Crow era of the South and the United States and talk about a new book by Dr. David Koven. There is a story behind the title of Dr. Koven's book and a story behind the writing of the novel itself. Dr. Koven is professor emeritus at Sacramento State. He has a PhD in political science. He is the founder of Blue Nile Press, which is Sacramento's only Black publishing company, and he's the founder of the Sacramento Black Book Fair. His new novel is titled Raisins and Milk, and we're going to talk about the title and about the writing process. Dr. Koven, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Would you start with a bit of your own history, because you were involved in the civil rights movement. Where were you at the time, and what was your participation?
During the civil rights movement, during the heyday, let me put it that way, of the civil rights movement, I was I was in high school, then I was in college, and later on I was in grad school. My involvement began earnestly in when I was in college. That's when the sit-ins were going on in the South. I was going to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, and we did sympathy demonstrations there. We picketed stores that were being picketed in the South and where people were being knocked off lunch counters and so on. So that's actually how I began to be involved in the movement. In fact, I lived in a fraternity house, and a woman came by and she said, "You know, all this stuff is going on. We need to do something about it." And she said, "We're meeting with people from the Black community in Champaign-Urbana and with the campus chapter of the NAACP. Will somebody go to the meeting with me?" I volunteered to go with her. And that she initiated my involvement. It was kind of lonely out there. We went. When she and I went to the meeting of that they were having with the campus people on the NAACP and the people from the Black community in Champaign-Urbana, on the campus side, we were the only two Black people there. So we were lonely, but we felt it was important, and people from the community were glad to see us there. And that's really what got me started. Once I went to grad school, I became even much more involved.
This is a book that you were writing in the early 1970s. The central character is a young woman named Ruth Ann Wethering. She was born in Florida. At the time that you were writing it, you happened to have an occasion to share it with the great American writer Toni Morrison. Do you want to take the story from there?
Toni Morrison was an editor at Random House, and I sent the manuscript to Random House. She read it, and she contacted me and said, we're very interested in this story. Maybe if you could revise it a bit, we could do something with it. I liked it a lot," she said. And so I did revise it, and I sent it back, and she said, it's very good, but something's missing, and it's not ready for us right now. So the story was my grandmother's story, and my grandmother lived with my parents and me almost all my life as I was growing up, and she would talk about her childhood. She liked to talk about her childhood. And she always began these stories with, when I was a girl, and she would go into something that had happened to her when she was a girl. So I used to follow her around and listen to her, and often she repeated the stories, and I had favorites, and I tried to get her to tell the favorites again, and she would. And as I grew older, the stories changed because she could put in more. As I was more mature, there was more she thought I could handle, and so she would introduce those elements into the stories that she told me. Raisins and Milk was one of those stories that she told me. When I was when my grandmother was born in 1902. So that was 37 years after emancipation, after the end of the Civil War. So a lot of the people that she knew in her neighborhood were people in Mandarin, Florida, were people who were alive during slavery. And her grandmother was alive during slavery. And these people had stories that they told her. Some of her stories that she told me came from them, and Raisins and Milk was one of them. Raisins and Milk came from a kind of shocking story that her grandmother told her, that the reason she didn't like raisins and the reason she didn't like milk was because of what went on when she was a child in slavery. They were fed. Well, let me begin here. The slaves, the enslaved people, were called around by a horn. So they blew the horn when it was time for them to get up. They blew the horn when it was time for them to go out in the fields. They blew the horn when there was a time to rest. They blew the horn when it was time to go back to their cabins. And this woman, my great-grandmother, told my grandmother that she didn't even remember them speaking at the place where they lived, the overseers speaking to them. They communicated with them solely by the horn as far as she could remember. She said probably they did talk to us, but that's not what I remember. And they blew the horn to feed, to eat, mealtime. Mealtime was a time when the people were coming into the fields at that particular plantation, were fed in a trough, and food was poured into the trough, and they had to eat out of that trough, scooping food into their mouths. And the food was always accompanied by milk. It was bad milk that the farm wasn't going to use, and they poured it into the trough for the slaves to eat out of. And so they were all famished, and the mess smelled horribly. But this is the only food they were going to get, so they dove into it, and it stank, and swarms of flies settled on that food in the trough. And they were scooping flies, sour milk, and whatever other remains were into the mess that they were eating and putting it into their mouths. And once slavery ended, my great-grandmother told my grandmother, I swore then that I would never have raisins or milk because the flies sitting on top of those that mess we had to eat looked just like raisins.
That is one of many examples in the book Raisins and Milk, in which we get a window into the inhumanity, into the pain, and also into the real-life stories of people who were surviving and in some cases not surviving slavery. I think the story is so rich in its characters, and it hurts, Dr. Coven. I think reading the book hurts. Although there is there's beauty and sunlight and joy in the people's lives as well. And the evolution of Ruth Ann, this is her coming of age story, is something that stays with you. There were times I had to put the book down and pause because of what I was afraid was coming or what had already happened. But I think it's really important reading right now. Why did you put it aside for so long after that exchange with Toni Morrison and only finish it more recently and release it now?
I didn't really put it aside. I kept working on it, tinkering with it, looking at it, revising it for years. At first I was trying to imagine what was missing, what wasn't there. What was the edge? And over time, I realized it was simply that I hadn't lived long enough. I didn't have the depth of experience to give the story what it needed. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I did, the initial story was much longer. It followed my grandmother from her youth into maturity and later on in her life. And it came to me that the most powerful part of the story was really the beginning. The times when she used to say to me, when I was a girl, and go into a story. So I began to condense the story to take out the part that came later and to focus on the kind of depth of experience that that girl had in that time. And until I got that right, I wasn't ready to come forward with it. And it took a long time to get that right. Hmm.
So all of the nightmare portion, the horse, the nightmare storyline, without giving any of it away, it's all true?
It's all true. This is fiction, so I've fictionalized it. But it all came from stories that my grandmother told me. I talk of her as being a fountain of memories. And she was and is. And I like to continue that fountain. And so others might have the same kinds of information about that time and that place.
I do want to encourage people to look for this book. It's titled Raisins in Milk. Dr. David Coven has written 5 books. He is, as I said, professor emeritus at Sacramento State. He founded Blue Nile Press and the Sacramento Black Book Fair. He has a book talk and signing this Saturday, August 4th. It will be at Underground Books in the afternoon from 2 to 4. And I know you're continuing to focus on civil rights efforts all over the world. Could I ask you before we go just to share a thought about where Sacramento is at this point in time in light of the Stephon Clark shooting and other cases that have been so high profile and so tense for the city?
Well, I think it's not just Sacramento. It's national. And where we are is where we've been for a long time. We've got a long way to go. Race and the meaning of race is still as important now as it was when my grandmother was a girl, as it was when I was a child. Tanya Faison, who's a leader of Black Lives Matter here in Sacramento, didn't live in Sacramento until 2014. So she wasn't here, but she came here. People from here have gone elsewhere. This is a national problem, and it's more than a problem. It's embedded in the nation. And Raisins in Milk is a window into some of the roots of this plague that still is here.
I'd like to continue this conversation at another time, Dr. Coven. Would you visit again?
Well, thank you. Be glad to.
It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
Again, Dr. David Coven will be at Underground Books on Saturday, August 4th, from 2 to 4. You've been listening to him on Insight. We'll post more about his work and his books at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Fashionista Boyfriend is a chill wave synth pop band from Sacramento. Huh, you said? They're going to explain what that is in the interview you're about to hear. The band started as a solo project for Casey Grote. He added James Petropoulos on bass, Miles Taylor on sax, and Austin Mooney on drums, and that completes the live sound. Casey Grote released his first record, Hypnophobia, in January of 2018, and Hypnophobia Remixes was released in May. Insight producer Cody Drabble recorded the band and an interview earlier this week, so here's Casey talking about the music on the new Tonal EP.
A lot of this stuff I actually wrote a long time ago, I think, you know, a couple years after high school. And I just really thought it was worthy to have it come out into the world. Got this band together after, you know, doing the solo thing for a while. I had a couple shows by myself, but I was like, this really needs a full band. So I brought along Austin and James and Miles.
How do you know the members of your band?
So James, the bassist, I actually knew him since middle school. We've been in a couple angsty bands since high school.
We had a screamo band.
What was your screamo band called?
High Tides.
High Tides.
When we say screamo, what are we talking about?
Well, don't really like to talk about it, but we will for the sake of the show. Basically, you know, just a lot of power chords, being angry and...
And how did you meet Miles?
So I actually met Miles through a mutual friend of mine. I was told that, you know, oh, if you're looking for a guy playing sax, I've got a friend. And I actually seen a couple concerts with him with CRC, yep. Commercial Ensemble, and he, you know, did his own solos and stuff, and I was like, he's the guy.
Miles, are you primarily a jazz guy?
I mean, for the most part, I like to stay open. You know, I just feel music is music, and so... if people bring a certain level of passion and creativity, then I'm down for it. And so I definitely saw that the first time I hung out with Casey and jammed with him, and I could just see the creativity just oozing out of him. And so I just wanted to be a part of it.
It was kind of like a test jam. You know, we would play stuff and see if we just vibed well together. And, you know, we really have good experience to try and, you know, try and get that together.
And Austin, how did you come into the band?
Casey actually found me initially on Craigslist, I think, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I had just moved back here from living in Pennsylvania for a little while and had been kind of searching around for something to do. And Craigslist is kind of a go-to for me when I don't have any projects to play in. So we met each other over the internet. I've got my own practice space where I keep my drums at. And so it was convenient to invite people over and start jamming. And initially it was just Casey and I, and then we grew it out and involved everybody else.
What was that initial Craigslist post that grabbed your attention? I mean, there's a lot of calls out there on the internet saying, hey, I need a drummer. What was it about
this? You know, this is going to sound terrible, but I can't remember. I think you contacted me first. And then when I kind of got a listen of what you were doing, I liked it. And I just wanted to play with that.
Sounds about right. Yeah.
You know, it's a style of music that, like, I felt like I listened to in my personal time, but I didn't feel like it would ever cross over into my professional life as a musician. And when I saw the opportunity, I just jumped on it. You know, it seems like that chill wave sound is something that people are listening to off of SoundCloud on the internet all the time. And to put it into the live setting seemed like a nice challenge and a good time.
Before you joined the band, what kind of music were you playing?
I've played a lot of different things. Hilariously, I also started in a lot of metal bands. My first band was Vesuvius out here in Sacramento, and that was kind of like a hard rock band. When I was living in Pennsylvania, I played with a band called Humandala. That was more along the lines of this, but less of the chill wave and more like modern electronic.
So, Casey, you started out with a screamo band.
Yes.
What made you pivot towards chill wave and synth-driven pop?
Kind of just over the years, I grew into a way different genre, you know, listening to different genres of music. The internet has been such a great way to exploit, you know, all sorts of different music. I probably wouldn't be able to be doing any of this stuff. I wouldn't have found out about my favorite influences without the internet.
Where does the band name come from?
So some of these members of the band didn't know the answer to that a week ago. And so they have to start telling people, like, well, how the name come about, and they don't know. So I had to, you know, give them the memo. So my girlfriend, when we first started dating, she started calling me a fashionista boyfriend because she would start asking me, like, what she should wear. And I was like, oh, well, no, well, the shoes don't really go with this and that. And then I would be like, does this go with that? Yeah, it goes with that. Okay, you know.
So you are the fashionista boyfriend.
I am the fashionista. Straight up, I'm the fashionista boyfriend. So.
And you just decided to own it.
Yeah.
We're all set up and sound checked and ready to play. What's the first song you want to play for us?
So the first song we're going to play is called Atlas. It's off the new EP.
Tell me a little bit about the song Atlas.
Atlas, I wrote, I think it was about the fourth song when I was writing the whole album, and I wanted each song on the album to just focus on something enjoyable in life. And so Atlas is kind of about, you know, finding yourself in different places, you know, like finding the tallest buildings, running through tunnels. It's really just about exploring.
This is Atlas from Fashionista Boyfriend. Was Atlas by Fashionista Boyfriend. The new record is the Tonal EP, which is available this weekend. So you guys are somewhat of a brand new band.
Oh, yeah. We only started practicing, what, like
a few months ago.
We were just counting it, sitting there in the green room trying to figure it out.
How many gigs have you played together?
One.
Does that include this one?
Yes, we'll include today.
Then two. We had our first show at Stone Vintage Music Boutique in West Sac. It just opened up, and it is phenomenal. It's a great place.
Your album release show at Momo Sacramento is going to be your third official gig as a band.
Yep.
Yes. Mm-hmm. How are you guys feeling about it?
Excited.
Nervous? Mm-hmm.
Excited and nervous. Yeah. And confident.
Excited. Yeah. Extremely excited.
Mm-hmm. Casey Grote, Austin Mooney, Miles Taylor, and James Petropoulos, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That's the music of Fashionista Boyfriend, which has a Tonal EP release party on Saturday. Actually, it's a joint release party with Topograph. So you can find videos of the band performing here and more information about that party August 4th at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. This weekend, the Peach House Presents Daydream Festival happens with 2 days this year of live bands, visual art, and food. In the studio with me is the founder and creative director of Peach House, Heron Palacios, and we're kind of combining a preview of the Dream Fest with sound advice this week. Hi, Heron.
Hi.
Glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
So just a little description of Daydream Fest.
Yeah, so Daydream Festival this year is a 2-day music festival. We have installation art, visual art, we're going to have video, food trucks, and vendors, and just a bunch of music.
And it happens where?
It's going to be happening at Latino Center of Art and Culture over on Front Street.
Okay, so a great lineup that includes Destroy Boys, Hanyak, Separate Spines. So tell me about the first clip we're going to hear.
So we actually have a few today. So we're going to be listening to Moonchild, great, great, great band. They're local. We also have the Shivas who are headlining. And then we also have the saxophones playing.
Okay, let's start with the sound of Moonchild.
Yeah, so they're a great, great band.
Find us what we're looking for, there's no way. Do I turn into LA someday?
Tell me about watching them. How are they visually?
Incredible. They have a great setup. They always put on great shows. Everyone comes out for them. And it's just great music to listen to in your car or live.
All right, the Shivas, let's hear their sound next.
I want to know the reason why you make me want to cry. You make me want to die. Cause you don't do the things you're supposed to do. You run around and make me blue. I'm so torn up on you.
I just couldn't resist hearing a little bit more of it.
Yeah, they're really great.
It's a fun sound. What was your criteria for the bands you chose?
I honestly, it's kind of just whatever I think was the best of the best locally. And I think a big part of whoever plays with Peach House is just that they're nice and great musicians.
Being nice counts for a lot these days,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
All right, let's listen to a little bit of the saxophones.
There's a pain in my teeth. There's a pain in my feet. There's a feeling of dread I can't reach.
But how did
did this festival come about? I know it was your inspiration and vision, but there's a big difference between dreaming of something and actually making it happen.
Yeah. So kind of what had happened was I was going through like a rough time about a year and a half ago, and I figured that I needed to stay busy. I saw someone post about wanting to do a house show just in his home, and I hit him up and I really wanted to do it. And then he's like, oh, my roommate's pulled out. And I had already like in my brain decided that's what I wanted to do. So I kind of just was like, well, it's already in my head. I've already planned it out in my head. Like, I might as well just go forward with it. And then I had put a post on Facebook saying, like, would anybody be interested in playing a show or helping out? And I want to say about 30 people responded.
Wow.
And so I, like, at the time was very nervous about that and didn't know how to say no. So I was just like, let's just do all of you guys. So it was the first show, and we just added everyone who responded initially. Wow. And who was still interested.
What did you do in your background that gave you confidence or even the desire to put on an event? Were you a performer in high school? Were you part of any kind of events in those years?
I played a little bit of music in high school, but mostly just working on art and stuff. It was really kind of a surprise for me. I had never really done anything like that before, but I decided I wanted to, and then I did, and then I fell in love with it.
What has the response told you about what niche was available to fill out there and how people want to come together?
Yeah, that was probably the biggest thing is almost everything that we did like cost-free, just like a little bit out of pocket. But for the most part, I didn't put too much in because the community wanted like just a like not we pay them, of course, but they didn't care about money. They didn't care about like how big it got. They just needed a place to play music, to show their art. They didn't care what it was. They just wanted that. And it's just been nonstop for the last year and a half.
Can you give me an example of a little something you learned? Like maybe it was about food or water bottles, electricity or whatever it might
yeah.
be.
I would probably say like probably two things. I had no idea about sound equipment. So I had no idea like what was needed. I was like, okay, music has to play, but how do we do that? So found out what a mixer was, what a PA system was for the first
really
time.
You really were a beginner.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so I got used to that a little bit. And also just I feel like the biggest thing was learning that most people, if you ask them for help, will want to help you.
Hmm. Have you ever thought of yourself as a brave person, as a bit of a pioneer?
Not really, but I think that's a sweet gesture.
I'm talking with Haron Palacios. She's the founder and creative director of Peach House, which presents the Daydream Festival in Sacramento. So this is year number two. What's your vision? Where do you want the festival to go?
My eventual goal is to create it so that it's still a weekend thing, maybe branch out to a two-weekend thing, or maybe a few days. But the idea is to format it kind of the same as I was really inspired by FYF Fest in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Coachella is also a big one. Outside Lands is a great one. But just having a big festival in Sacramento and making that Sacramento like a highlight for touring bands.
Let's listen to a clip of one more band. This is Vita Solstice.
Yes.
We're lying to ourselves. I ain't nobody showed you. You know what it's about. We gotta stop all the smoking.
Music is beautiful. The art installations come from a long list of contributors, including Styles Munson, Laura Marie Anthony, Maddie Smith, many others.
Yeah, there's quite a few on there.
Where does the phrase Peach House come from?
So originally it was actually the name of my house. So we like, it was like a thing to, you know, name your house for house shows or creative spots. And I thought that would be cute. And, my old apartment was just this like mess of a place. The porch was like breaking, falling off. The paint had been completely like torn, peeled away. And it was the opposite of peachy. And so we called it the Peach House because it was just, it looked like, I don't know, monsters lived there or something. And so we named it that. And then when I started doing the festival, I didn't want to put it under my own name. So I was like, I'll just keep it under the Peach House. So that's, it kind of just carried over.
What do people need to know to come out and enjoy the festival? Any advice, any guidance, any how to come and hear the hear and see the show?
I would say just come with people that you enjoy being with, have a nice time, be nice to everyone who's also participating. We're all just trying to, you know, be a nice crowd, supportive group. But yeah, just don't be mean.
Peach House, though, includes more than music.
Yeah, yeah. So we kind of do a little bit of everything. It's whatever I feel that Sacramento, just the creative community, might need. So we've done trans queer clothing swaps, queer POC dance nights that have been really fun, normal shows, just like live music. But we also have gallery shows, fundraisers, kind of a little bit of everything.
That's Heron Palacios, founder and creative director of Peach House Presents. The Daydream Fest is this weekend in Sacramento. More details at capradio.org/insight and much more for you online. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks, Heron.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us.